Well, we now come to the 18th president of the United States, Ulysses S. Grant, and a lot of my memory is tied to him. We're actually from the show Wild Wild West back in the day, and then you have different mythological things that would come up on a regular basis, but I want to deal with the facts as has been given to us by the different primary resources that we can pull from. And but first of all, as we've been doing, we look at some of the fun facts. Sometimes they're not so much fun, but some of the facts concerning these individuals. And the first one concerning Ulysses S. Grant is that the S in Grant's name didn't stand for anything. He was also known as Ulysses during his youth in Ohio. Grant's given name was actually Hiram Ulysses Grant. His phantom middle initial is the result of an error from Ohio Congressman Thomas Hammer, who accidentally wrote the future general's name as Ulysses S. Grant when he nominated him to attend West Point. And despite Grant's best efforts to correct that record, that name stuck, and he eventually accepted it as his own. And he said, "Find some name beginning with S for me," he joked in an 1844 letter to his future wife, Julia Dent. "You know, I have an S in my name and don't know what it stands for." So we see him being able to joke about that. And another thing about him is that he was notoriously unlucky in business. After spending a decade in the Army and serving with distinction in the Mexican-American War, Grant resigned his post in 1854 and spent the next 7 years flopping as a farmer, real estate agent, and rent collector. He once had to eke out a living by selling firewood on St. Louis street corners, and when the Civil War erupted, he was toiling away in obscurity at his family's Galena, Illinois leather business. Grant would later try his hand at business a second time after he left the White House, with equally disastrous results. A financial firm he started with his son and a man named Ferdinand Ward went belly up after Ward fleeced its investors, and by 1884, Grant was bankrupt. It was only after his publication of his memoirs that his fortune was restored. And so we see that a lot of times we've got this picture of presidents and everything going well. Well, that was not the case for Grant. Grant won the first major Union victory of the Civil War. Grant struggled to secure a field command at the outbreak of the Civil War, but later placed in charge of a regiment of Illinois volunteers and quickly promoted to the rank of brigadier general. The first display of his trademark aggressive style came in February 1862, when he forced the capitulation of some 15,000 Confederates at Tennessee's Fort Donelson. Quote, "No terms except complete and unconditional surrender can be accepted," end of quote. He famously warned the garrison's commander. The victory marked the first time in the war that a full Confederate force was captured, and grateful Northerners inundated unconditional surrender Grant, U.S. Grant, with cigars after it was reported that he smoked one during the attack. Before the war ended, Grant would accept the surrender of two more rebel armies at Vicksburg, Mississippi, and Appomattox Courthouse, Virginia. Fourthly, he struggled with alcohol throughout his life. Grant's taste for strong drink first became problematic in the early 1850s, when he was reportedly forced to resign from the Army for being caught drunk on duty. He swore off alcohol for most of the next decade, only to fall off the wagon during the Civil War. He had this penchant for binge drinking, was usually kept in check by his teetotaler, one that would come alongside him, Colonel John Rollins, but rumors that he was intoxicated during battles swirled around him for most of the war. And for his part, Abraham Lincoln appeared unperturbed by the gossip. When a group of congressmen once alleged that Grant was a drunk, the president supposedly responded by asking what kind of whiskey the general preferred. "I urged them, quote, to ascertain and let me know." Lincoln later said, for it made fighting generals like Grant. I should like to get some of it for distribution. He also hated wearing army uniforms. He received numerous demerits for his unkempt uniforms during his days at West Point, and his distaste for military dress continued even after he assumed supreme command of the Union Army during the Civil War. He also was supposed to be at the theater with Lincoln at the night of his assassination. Grant was invited to join Abraham Lincoln at Ford's Theater on that fateful evening of April 14, 1865, but was forced to decline after he and his wife made plans to visit their children in New Jersey. He was informed of the president's assassination when his train stopped later that night. Grant later described Lincoln's death as the darkest day of my life, and bitterly regretted not having been at his side. Despite being a potential target himself, he was convinced he would have somehow stopped John Wilkes Booth from pulling the trigger. Grant also prevented Robert E. Lee from being charged with treason after the Civil War. When he accepted the surrender of Robert E. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia in April 1865, Grant offered generous terms that paroled Confederate soldiers and officers and allowed them to return to their homes. He even permitted the men to keep their horses and mules for use as farm animals. Grant really believed that leniency was critical to achieving a lasting peace, and he was furious when a federal grand jury later negated the terms of his agreement and charged Lee and several other Confederate generals with treason. During a subsequent meeting with President Andrew Johnson, he stated his intention to resign the command of the army rather than execute any order to arrest Lee or any of his commanders so long as they obey the law. Unwilling to lose Grant's support, Johnson reluctantly dropped the case. He had no political experience before becoming president. His time in charge of the Union Army notwithstanding, Grant was a political novice when he was inaugurated as the 18th president in 1869. He'd never held any elected position and had shown little interest in running for office before the Republican Party nominated him as its candidate. Critics would later blame his lack of experience for the economic turmoil and scandals that dogged his administration, a claim that Grant himself acknowledged. He said, quote, "It was my fortune or misfortune to be called to the office of chief executive without any previous political training," he wrote in his final message to Congress. "Under such circumstance, it is but reasonable to suppose the errors of judgment must have occurred." End of quote. After the newly formed Ku Klux Klan began murdering and terrorizing black Americans in the late 1860s, President Grant mobilized the Justice Department and secured thousands of indictments against their leaders. And in 1871, he also oversaw passage of the so-called Ku Klux Klan Act, which armed him with the power to declare martial law and suspend habeas corpus in areas deemed to be in a state of insurrection. The law got its first test later that year when Grant sent troops into South Carolina and ran thousands of Klansmen out of the state. And thanks to his administration's efforts, the hooded extremists were effectively cowed into submission over the next few years. They wouldn't resurface in force until the 1910s. And then Mark Twain was the one who published his memoirs. Grant first began compiling his memoirs in the late 1880s after he wrote a series of popular articles about his Civil War experiences. He was on the verge of signing a book deal with a magazine when novelist Mark Twain swooped in and offered a much more lucrative contract with his newly formed publishing firm, Charles L. Webster & Company. Grant took Twain up on his offer and later finished the book just a few days before succumbing to cancer in July of 1885. The personal memoirs of U.S. Grant hit the stores later that year and was immediately hailed by Twain and others as a literary masterpiece. It was also a massive bestseller. After the book was published, Grant's widow, Julia, received a whopping $450,000 in royalties. Well, as we continue on here, the president's 250 years of American political leadership, the author Ian Dale talks about some of the roots of Hiram Ulysses S. Grant. He was born in Point Pleasant, Ohio on April 27th of 1822. His father was a tanner, and the smell of the tannery would disturb Grant all his life. This battlefield soldier preferred his food well-cooked because he could not stand the smell of blood. His paternal ancestors had landed at Massachusetts Bay Colony in 1620, making him what passes for a kind of aristocrat in the United States, just without money and status. His mother was descended from Protestant immigrants from County Tyrone. Grant was born less than a year after his parents married. They drew his name Ulysses out of a hat and named him Hiram after his grandfather. Five more children followed, and by then the Grant family was living in Ohio. Grant's uncanny ability with horses was evident from an early age, an affinity that saved him from life in the family tannery. He drove his father's wagons and learned to ride well. Horses loved him. Quite quiet and reserved, he expressed no desire to make his religion a public matter. So we start to see where his roots are when it comes to the spiritual aspect. An unusual thing for an American at that time. No one bothered him about church going, and it was assumed that he was an agnostic. He liked to keep them assuming. Well, the book entitled The Faith of the Presidents by John M. Wiley talks about this a little bit. As several presidents before had espoused, Ulysses S. Grant seemed to be yet another president that was never officially part of one denomination, though he nevertheless retained a strong sense of Christian belief. In the Grant household, his wife seems to have been more devout and was indeed a member of the Methodist denomination. One story of Grant alleges that he had been ill to the degree of being bedridden and that a Methodist minister splashed the sleeping Grant with water, allowing the minister to declare that Grant had been baptized by sprinkling. Most Baptist probably would have a problem or two with that form of baptism. On a more serious note, a Civil War chaplain, James L. Crane, once said the following about Grant's religious views. Quote, Grant belongs to no church organization, yet he entertains and expresses the highest esteem for all the enterprises that tend to promote religion. When at home, he generally attended the Methodist Episcopal Church, with which some of the members of his family were connected. While he was colonel of the 21st Regiment, he gave every encouragement and facility for securing a prompt and uniform observance of religious services, and was generally found in the audience listening to preaching. According to some researchers, Grant was yet less faithful in church attendance and even got into trouble for church absences while a student at West Point. But perhaps as he aged, and especially since being married to his wife Julia, Grant became a more reliable churchgoer, which is sometimes witnessed in modern-day America today. Ulysses S. Grant is probably best known for his stalwart effort on the battlefield in the Civil War. Perhaps even the most consequential character of the bloody conflict, now roughly 160 years old. But his statements on separation of church and state are still especially of note. While speaking 100 years past the start of the American Revolutionary War, Grant argued, quote, now the centennial year of our nation's existence, I believe, is a good time to begin the work of strengthening the foundations of the structure commenced by our political forefathers 100 years ago at Lexington. Let us labor to add all needful guarantees for the security of free thought, free speech, a free press, pure morals, un, fettered religious sentiments and of equal rights and privileges to all men, irrespective of nationality, color, or religion. Encourage free schools and resolve that not $1 appropriated for their support shall be appropriated to the support of any sectarian schools. Resolve that neither the state nor nation nor both combined shall support institutions of learning than those sufficient to afford to every child growing up in the land the opportunity of a good common school education, unmixed with sectarian, pagan, or atheistic dogmas. Leave the matter of religion to the family altar. The church and the private school support entirely by private contributions. Keep the church and state forever separate. With these safeguards, I believe the battles which created the Army of the Tennessee will not have been fought in vain. So he was vigilant in guarding against state-sponsored churches, but he was no secularist. He had big problems with paganism and atheism. Well, in the book, The Presidents and Their Faith by Grinder and Shaw, we see that Grant thought of God as impersonal and somewhat removed providence. At his first inauguration on March 4th, 1869, he asked the nation to pray to Almighty God for his administration's efforts following the conclusion of the Civil War. And in his second inaugural address of March 4th, 1873, he referred again simply to providence. He also declared, "I believe that our great Maker is preparing the world in his own good time to become one nation speaking one language and when armies and navies will no longer be required." So we've got historians and political scientists. They rank usually Grant's presidency near the bottom of effective and ethical administration. Yet Grant was the only president between Abraham Lincoln and Woodrow Wilson to be elected to two consecutive terms of office. And one noted historian has described Grant as the most underrated American in history. As Gene Edward Smith argues, quote, "Grant was condemned because of what he stood for. As president, he fought for black equality long after his countrymen had tired of the Negro question. And in his first inaugural address, for example, Grant called the adoption of the 15th Amendment. He hated vindictiveness against, according to Smith, and no other president carried on such a determined struggle against such hopeless odds to protect the freedmen in the exercise of their constitutional rights. Well, we see a little bit into the heart of Ulysses S. Grant in correspondence with Lincoln during the Civil War. Listen to this letter that we find in the book Ulysses S. Grant by Josiah Bunting III from Abraham Lincoln. This is July 13th, 1863. "My dear General, I do not remember that you and I ever met personally. I write this now as grateful acknowledgement for the almost inestimable service you have done the country. I wish to say a word further. When you first reached the vicinity of Vicksburg, I thought you should do what you finally did, march the troops across the neck, run the batteries with the transports, and thus go below. And I never had any faith except a general hope that you knew better than I, that the Yazoo Pass expedition and the like would succeed. When you got below and took Port Gibson, Grand Gulf, and vicinity, I thought you should go down the river and join General Nathaniel Banks. And when you turned northward, east of Big Black, I feared it was a mistake. I now wish to make the personal acknowledgement that you were right and I was wrong. Yours very truly, Abraham Lincoln." What a great letter to get from the president at that time. Well, we see people looking at Grant in a way that they just didn't get. Why is this guy? How did he step into power in such a way? In the book, Grant Takes Command by Bruce Catton, he talks about how they're just floored by how simplistic this guy is. They say this: he was altogether too simple and transparent. They would have better enjoyed the deep thunders of a martial voice, the imperative clap of bells, the swift spring of saluting aides. They were troubled in some cases with the conviction that Ulysses Grant was not so much of a general after all. They told the folks at home that Ulysses was mighty glad to see them and talk things over with them, and they didn't see how in the world he ever came into that position anyhow. It was just his darn luck. In the book, The American Presidents, by David C. Whitney, this is a book about the biographies of our chief executives, they start to see why he struggled in his administration. Grant revealed his political ineptitude with his initial cabinet appointment. So listen to how he put together his cabinet. He chose two old friends from Galena as secretaries of state and war, one of whom resigned and the other of whom died during the first year of the administration. He appointed as a secretary of the treasury a millionaire war contractor who was forced out of office within a few days because of conflict of interest with government business. And as his secretary of the Navy, he named a millionaire banker who resigned within 3 months because the cabinet position took too much of his time. So we have this man who seemed to just do well with relationships, but not with necessarily the administration of a political government. And we see later, or we see or saw earlier, that when it came to business, he struggled. But we want to come back to the fact that these spiritual roots are what is the basis of us doing these podcasts together. It said in the book, back to the book by Grinder and Shaw, it talks about the fact that in his second inaugural address, Grant also addressed the plight of American Indians. He said, quote, "Wars of extermination are expensive even against the weakest people and are demoralizing and wicked. Our superiority of strength and advantages of civilization should make us lenient toward the Indian. The moral view of the question should be considered, and the question asked, cannot the Indian be made a useful and productive member of society by proper teaching and treatment? If the effort is made in good faith, we will stand better before the civilized nations of the earth and in our own consciences for having made it." Well, we see that Grant died on July 23rd, 1885, and his funeral in New York City was a testament to national reconciliation. In his dying days in the spring and summer of 1885, a Methodist minister and bishop, the Reverend J.P. Newman, spent time, in parentheses it says here, uninvited as he was, with Grant, trying to secure some kind of confession of faith from Grant, but without any success. Shortly after his death, in one of his pockets, Julia Grant found a note he had written to her, which read in part, "Look after our children and direct them in the paths of rectitude. It would distress me far more to hear that one of them could depart from an honorable, upright, and virtuous life than it would to know that they were prostrated on a bed of sickness from which they would never to arise alive. I bid you final farewell until we meet in another, and I trust, better